It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker. Rob Ferret is off today. Coming up later, we'll look at the push to expand one of northern Wisconsin's busiest highways. First, a scheduled vote on a new school accountability bill was postponed in the state assembly yesterday. The chair of the Assembly Education Committee called off voting on an amended version of the school accountability bill that calls for major changes to state education policy, along with strict new sanctions for low-performing schools. With us now is Erin Richards. She covers K-12 education as well as state politics related to education issues for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Erin, welcome back to Central Time.
Hello, thank you.
So why did the Assembly Education Committee chair call off the vote yesterday?
Well, that's the question of the day. But the short answer is there weren't enough votes for it to pass. So if you don't have the votes to get a bill passed, you call off the executive session for which that vote was scheduled to happen.
Well, there are actually two bills in the spotlight here. One is the so-called pause bill, and the other is the amended education bill, the updated version of the Assembly School Accountability Bill. Can you kind of give us a one-on-one on each of those?
Yep. So the pause bill is a bill that has bipartisan support that would, for 1 year, prohibit the test scores on this new state test that's being administered right now to kids in third through eighth grade. It would stop those scores from this first administration of the new test from counting on schools' performance report cards for next year, and as well as the new statewide teacher evaluations. So both of those performance reports, both for teachers and for schools, were set up to be able to include state test scores. That's kind of how you judge, or at least right now, how we're judging how schools are doing. Because there have been a bunch of bumps with this new state test, the lawmakers have said, you know what, why don't we just take a year off, let this first test go through, we'll publicly report the results, but we're not going to issue report cards to schools that are basically based on them. And, you know, if kids really tank on the test and the results look terrible, they don't want to sort of, you know, inappropriately punish schools and teachers because of that. That bill has bipartisan support. The Senate is scheduled to, the Senate Education Committee was scheduled to vote on that today. It was supposed to pass, and then the full Senate should take it up next week. The problem is the Assembly on that bill, they were also scheduled to vote on that today, the Assembly Education Committee, but the head of that committee called off the vote on the bill that has consensus, as well as this other bill we'll talk about that does not have consensus. So at the moment, the measure to pause the state test score results from counting for anything is moving ahead in the Senate, but is not moving ahead yet in the Assembly.
Now, you said this was a complicated thing, and that the short answer, there weren't enough votes, and that's why the vote was halted. What's the more complicated answer?
Well, on Tuesday, lawmakers in the Assembly Education Committee got their hands on a heavily amended school accountability bill. Now, there's a lot of education proposals in the State House right now, so it's okay if people lost track of this one. This was the bill that had a 12-hour hearing back in January. A lot of people were concerned about it because it proposes laying out some pretty strict sanctions for failing schools, including, for example, turning failing public schools into independent charter schools. That provoked a lot of controversy and debate. The Assembly pulled back on it, and then on Tuesday, we got a new version of that bill that had a whole bunch of changes that nobody had seen before. The text was just made public Tuesday. And then the chair of the Assembly Education Committee said, okay, we're going to vote on this on Thursday. Usually, heads of committees don't schedule votes unless they know they have the votes to pass the bill. We found out a day later that the vote had been called off, which indicates to all of us that actually he did not have the votes to pass this amended Assembly accountability bill. So what's in the amended version of this accountability bill? Some of the same stuff we saw before, giving schools letter grades, A, B, C, D in terms of how they're doing rather than descriptors of their performance for the previous year. There is still a proposal in there that would, after a number of years, potentially turn a failing public school into a charter school, though they would get some support from the state first to try some different improvement tactics. But it also tucks in some completely new proposals that even I'm not sure exactly where they came from. For example, if a public school was failing, it would have to send letters to parents in the district that inform them of all their other options of schools to attend besides that public school. So that's why this bill, you know, a lot of the Democrats said, hey, wait a minute, this is really moving quickly. We haven't even had a hearing on these changes. So that's why I think there was enough rumbling behind the scenes, and then ultimately, without having the votes there, that's why the Jeremy Thiesfeldt, who chairs the Assembly Education Committee, halted, you know, or at least postponed this vote.
And it seems as though part of this might be the fact that the Senate and the Assembly have different ideas, or at least they have seemed to have different ideas about how to hold low-performing schools accountable. What are the sticking points there?
A big sticking point is what to do with schools that, for many reasons, are your longtime low-performing schools. There are a lot of schools in Wisconsin that are doing okay. There's a lot of schools in Wisconsin that are doing great. There's a number of schools, especially in high-poverty, challenged urban areas, that have a lot of troubles. And there are some lawmakers that would like to see more aggressive sanctions on schools that fail to perform well over time. There's another philosophy, even among people in the Republican Party, that says, you know, a lot of times low performance is a product of high poverty areas, and schools can't be expected to fix all of this stuff. So if they're going to have low test scores, what is the best way for us to help them rather than imposing strict penalties on them? So I think what you're seeing is a real divide in the Republican Party between folks who have very different ideas on how to best improve low-performing public schools. Do we turn them over to a different type of management company? Do we give them extra money to improve? Do we allow the state superintendent to take stronger steps? These are all various, you know, ideas for improving the schools, but what you're seeing in the state legislature right now is sort of these competing ideas really, you know, bumping up against each other, even though we're talking about leading Republicans in both the Senate and the Assembly.
Is there any indication that there might be more of an appetite to agree to turn failing public schools into charter schools in the Senate, where it had been a tougher sell?
I'm not seeing that yet. I'm not ruling out the fact that it can happen, but in general, the Assembly has taken a much more moderate approach to the idea of charter school, charter school takeovers or charter school turnarounds as the solution for improving low-performing schools. That said, we've seen, you know, Senator Alberta Darling, who's from, the Milwaukee suburban area, she's given some indications that she would be interested in a bill that may propose a charter school district within the Milwaukee Public Schools area. That's not actually a bill yet. It's just been talked about. So certainly there's been some appetite, but I don't think we're seeing enough movement. I just don't think there's a consensus yet in the Senate to really use that as the hammer to improve low-performing schools.
So there's a lot of background action, no consensus yet. Where do you see both of these bills heading next?
The problem is this entire idea of how to grade schools' performance and then how to hold them accountable has been hung up in the legislature for several years now. We've seen various versions of this accountability bill implode in previous legislative sessions. So what's going to have to happen is lawmakers are going to have to figure out how they actually want to hold schools accountable, what's important to measure, how do we better weight the fact that a high-poverty school is going to have a much harder time getting to a high level of student performance than a wealthy school in a well-resourced suburban area. Lawmakers have to decide on that, and then they have to say, okay, what's going to be the incentive for improvement? And I don't know if that's going to come together this session. I know a lot of people would like it to, but we're just not seeing the movement on that yet.
Well, Erin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Erin Richards, education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard. 2 weeks ago, we spoke with one of our reporters covering Superior Days, an annual advocacy event where leaders from northern Wisconsin come to the state capitol to lobby for issues of importance to their part of the state. One of the big items at this year's event, as well as in previous years, was the proposed expansion of Highway 2, the major east-to-west thoroughfare in northern Wisconsin. Leaders there were hoping for a four-lane expansion, but it's an idea the State Department of Transportation hasn't been receptive to so far. Here with us now to follow up on that story are two of the area's economic development leaders. Scotty Sandstrom is the executive director of the Bayfield County Economic Development Corporation. Scotty, welcome to the program.
Hello.
And Dale Kupchak is with us, too. He's the executive director of the Ashland Area Development Corporation. Dale, welcome to you.
And good afternoon to you also.
And Dale, we'll start with you. Why do you think Highway 2 in northern Wisconsin should be expanded?
Well, a number of reasons. Number one, I've been in economic development here for about 17 years, and at this time we get a number of requests for proposals from Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, the former Department of Commerce, and it's for companies looking to move into Wisconsin or companies looking to expand in Wisconsin. And there are basically five questions that you have to answer. One is, do you have enough industrial park land to fit our needs? We can answer yes to that. Do you have sufficient water and sewer available to fit our needs? Yes, we can answer that. Do you have sufficient natural gas and electricity to meet our needs? The answer is yes. Do you have an airport that can handle a corporate jet? Yes. The last question, are you within 5 miles of a four-lane highway? No. If you cannot respond yes to all five questions, then you cannot respond to the proposal. So that eliminates northern Wisconsin from trying to attract businesses from out of the state or out of the area into northern Wisconsin.
Do you see that as something that's hindered the economic development of Wisconsin so far, Scotty?
Well, it certainly does delay the growth, because we've seen, as the connection from north of Eau Claire up to Superior, the initial push for that four lane started about 30 years ago, and when that came to fruition, about 10 years after that began, it really did create a good economic boost for Superior. They have some very viable, strong hubs for shipping, the trucking industry there, and so it really has made a stronger promise for that that area. So we see that as what would happen here, that the four-lane would just boost the opportunities for growth, as Dale said, to be able to bid on proposals for companies to come in so we could grow more jobs here.
And Dale, let's go to you next. If there were to be a four-lane expansion of Highway 2, currently a two-lane highway, what do you see as being the outcome, the difference in northern Wisconsin's future?
I think there'd be a big difference. You know, like we said, you know, a lot of your larger companies do not want to ship product on a two-lane because of time frame. Also, tourism. I know as my family, we're going on vacation. We're headed to a destination. We want to get there. With a four-lane, that would give the opportunity to get there much quicker, and I think it would bring more people into northern Wisconsin. And just for a quick point, we are really appreciative of the DOT for putting in passing lanes and trying to improve Highway 2. We really appreciate that, but we're just looking for the next step here.
And for people who aren't familiar with Highway 2, this is an east-west road. How big a thoroughfare is this in northern Wisconsin, Dale?
Basically, it would be from just east of Superior, on where Highway 2 and 53 meet, to Hurley, where 2 and 51 meet, and then from Hurley down to Tomahawk. And it's basically 160 miles.
And some people are saying that this proposed expansion mirrors that of Highway 53, the major highway leading to northern Wisconsin. What effect did that expansion have, do you think, Scotty?
Well, I mentioned some of that earlier, but it really did tie the west side of the state to the four-lane system as it ties to the Interstate 35 going south of Duluth as well, but it just did the whole loop, you know, down to Madison, over to Milwaukee, and so forth. So for the businesses up in the Superior market to get their products to market sooner, it certainly had improved that just tremendously.
Dale, what have you heard just sort of anecdotally, talking to business people, talking to people who drive the highway because they're on vacation with their families? What do people say about the experience of driving a two-lane Highway 2?
Well, I think, you know, the experience is nice. But again, we talk about the economics of it, shipping, and then, you know, if you're on vacation, most people want to get to the destination. And I think that is a big thing. You know, up here with a two-lane, there's not much for, you know, you have the forest is next to the highway, it's good scenery, but the other side of it is, you know, it's a little bit harder to drive on a two-lane up here. Especially in the wintertime with the snow and icy conditions, I think it, for safety is another reason to be much better. Even though we are a very safe bunch of drivers in northern Wisconsin, and that's one of the reasons that the DOT has given that there's not a lot of priority because of we are safe drivers. If there were a lot of safety issues, then it would be more of a priority.
And there's, you know, a lot of heavy traffic, trucking traffic, logging traffic comes all the way from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan all the way through. And, of course, as Dale mentioned, we're thankful for the passing lanes that have been affected here, but it would just streamline that even more with the severe weather that we do have, the critical care of vehicles and so forth. It would just, again, help the safety very much.
Now, over the years, the State Department of Transportation, it's been reluctant to approve this project. This time seems to be another case in that point. Dale, why is that?
I think there's a couple reasons. One of them I mentioned is that funding is a big issue nowadays. As you know, the politics in Madison, and, you know, there's not funding. We were told when we were in Madison there's going to be two major projects funded, and they're both in southern Wisconsin this year. So I think funding is a big issue. I think nobody wants to raise gas taxes, and they have been raising a number of years. So I think that's an issue. The cost of road construction has gone up considerably in the last 10, 15 years, you know, since the last gas tax was raised. And I think just overall, it's just I guess the one example would be with the money that was given back in tax refunds last year, was probably about $800 million. And the cost of the four-lane highway is basically $1 million per mile each way. So that's $2 million. So if you take that $2 million a mile times 160 miles, about $320 million, that would have paid for the project from Superior to Tomahawk. Also would have created a large amount of construction jobs over the next 5 to 10 years. So, I mean, there are ways to do it, but I think it's just the fact that we're northern Wisconsin and there's more traffic in southern Wisconsin, middle part of the state, so I think that's kind of the priority at this time.
Scotty, now that a proposed iron ore mine in northern Wisconsin seems like it's off the table, at least for now, does this further hurt the chances that this project could be approved?
Well, it certainly creates a challenge of maybe a closer time frame, but we understand that in order to do anything, one needs to be persistent, and we've done that over the years on this project. And what was shared down at Superior Days with the Secretary Gottlieb, we asked the question, you know, from here on, you know, what should we do to kind of keep this in front of you folks? And he shared that the DOT has a Transportation Projects Commission, and that's one of the ways that certainly be a initiative to help us continue to keep in touch with this issue, and Dale and I are intending to look more into that and see how that we don't let it lie, but be persistent, and we just feel it's very crucial for the economic development of the area and for the other issues that we shared. So yes, it can put a challenge into it, but we will go forward.
If I could add one thing to that,
mm-hmm.
Without the mine, it's not a negative thing. The other side of the coin there is we have a large logging industry up here, and we have a very poor rail service up here. So we have more logging trucks on the road than really should be in order for the loggers to get their wood to market. So with a freeway, four-lane system, that would alleviate some of the congestion and things like that. So there's both sides of the coin. Without the mine, it might be detrimental, but on the same side, without good rail, it's a negative because it would be better to have the four lanes for the heavy truck traffic we have with the logging industry.
And Dale, just briefly as we wrap up, the Transportation Secretary has said that they're not going to expand this. They're going to focus on areas where congestion and safety are bigger concerns. He said, absent an enormous amount of money being dropped on us, I don't see it happening. Just being honest with you. What's your response?
And I understand that, but that's the reason we need to work with the legislature. They need to come up with more funding, whether it be raise a gas tax or anything. You know, cost of things keep going up, and infrastructure is a big part of economic development. Without infrastructure, you know, earlier, first part of the show, I did talk about the five questions they ask. It's all about infrastructure.
And we leave it there. Scotty and Dale, thank you so much for joining us. That was Scotty Stanstrom, Executive Director of the Bayfield County Economic Development Corporation, and Dale Krupchak, Executive Director of the Ashland Area Development Corporation. You're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is off today. Well, tomorrow, March 14th, is Pi Day. For the uninitiated, it's a fun day honoring the mathematical symbol pi, where people celebrate by, I don't know, listing as many digits in the number that they can, or, of course, eating lots of pie, which is, I think, the preferred method of celebration. While most of us associate pies with the sweet ones, apple, banana cream, we're talking about another kind of dish this time, pot pies. Savory meat pies have been around for hundreds of years, and they were once considered a delicacy. Anna Thomas Bates is a freelance writer who blogs at tallgrasskitchen.com. She also writes columns for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Edible Madison, and Brava magazine. She joins us now to talk about the history of the pot pie and give us some easy recipes to try at home. Anna, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Veronica.
Well, Anna, what made you decide to write about pot pies?
You know, it's just a different spin. Everybody, just like you said, loves apple, loves cherry. Those are delicious and wonderful. But frankly, any warm, delicious filling with pastry is excellent, and it's nice to be able to have it for your dinner course.
And we've still got a little bit of that spring chill in the air. Is there a special appeal to having pot pies warm and bubbling and savory when it's a little cold still?
It is. It's the perfect time. We're not going to get into those hot, scorching summer weather for quite a while, so it's not a burden to turn on your hot oven, and it fills up your kitchen with delicious smells, and it feels warm, and it's really great on those chilly evenings.
Now, in your column in the Journal Sentinel, you talk about the history of meat pies during the Middle Ages. It's fascinating, a little grotesque, but interesting. Tell us a little bit about some of this history.
Yeah, times have changed a little bit. Back in the day, like in medieval England, pot pies would grace the tables of kings and queens, and birds were by far the most popular. And some of the strangest anecdotes that I read about were, first of all, they would put some sort of decoration on top of the pie to indicate what type of meat was filling it. And for birds, it was often an actual stuffed bird. So they would have a swan, a peacock, a pheasant, a large stuffed bird on top of the pie to indicate that that's what was inside. There's also some other fantastical stories of somehow, and I cannot for the life of me figure out how they did this, actually baked live birds into a pie so that when it was cut open, they would fly throughout the banquet hall, which sounds like it could go wrong so many different ways.
And the birds didn't die while it was being baked?
Well, my guess is they must have had to have just put a cooked pastry lid over the top. That would be my best guess, but who knows. But they also cooked the birds, small birds, often whole, right into the pie. So the bones must not have been an issue back in the day, but they would actually have whole, you know, very small birds like partridges and even very small chicks baked right into a pie.
Wow. Well, call me crazy, but I'm kind of glad that we don't do pot pies like that anymore. Yeah. How have pot pies changed over the years?
You know, I mean, over recent times, it's still quite simple. It's a butter and flour thickened sauce with vegetables and a meat, and then a pastry lid. So, and it can really be as easy or as complicated as you'd like it to be, or as labor-intensive as you'd like it to be. But kind of the gold standard nowadays is a chicken pot pie. So carrots, peas, onions, a nice thick buttery sauce, and then a pastry lid on top.
Now, those historical pot pies you were just talking about, they sound like they were pretty elaborate and celebratory, fit for a king. Are pot pies these days, I mean, can they still be like that, or do they just run the gamut now?
You know, like I said, if you really go the whole nine yards and you cook your meat and you make your sauce from scratch and cut up all your vegetables and make your pastry from scratch, it's still going to be, you know, I would say a Sunday dinner affair. It's going to take some time to do all those steps, and it will be well worth it because your house will smell amazing and people can taste the love that went into that dish because it took some time to prepare. But you can also take some shortcuts that are still going to yield a really delicious dinner, but it's something you could do on a Wednesday night. And some of those shortcuts would be maybe getting a rotisserie chicken or pre-roasted chicken or meat already from the store. I still advocate that you can whip up biscuits or pastry pretty quickly, but if you don't want to do that, a really nice alternative is puff pastry. You can find puff pastry in the grocery store and look for one that has very simple ingredients, including butter, and then you're just going to roll that out and put that on top, and it's going to make things very simple and quick.
It's usually frozen, isn't it, puff pastry?
It is. It is, but by the time, if you get it out on the counter and unwrap it and let it sit there while you organize your other ingredients, it's going to be thawed enough that you can give it a few rolls and put it on top.
One thing about that history again, it seems like even when there were birds involved, meat involved in the pie, it was still kind of sweet. There were raisins or cinnamon or currants or something that sweetened it up. Is that legacy still alive in the pot pies we eat today?
You know, it's interesting how much our tastes have changed. A lot of the old recipes I looked at included not only dried fruit, but sugar as well. In the story, I included some bits of a recipe that actually had herring and sugar and raisins, and which just really sounds awful to me. But what that evolved to is kind of the mincemeat of today. Some people still do traditional mincemeat, which is beef suet and then raisins and lots of dried fruits. More people just do the dried fruit now and actually get rid of the beef suet, but that's the closest you'd find today to find that really sweet version. But also, if you look to other cultures, in Morocco, there's the bistilla, which is a pigeon pie, but you can use chicken or squab or something like that, and they include raisins, and kind of that savory and sweet contrast on a simpler level can actually be quite nice. I could imagine a turkey and cranberry pot pie.
Huh. Have you tried any of those historical throwback ones, herrings and sugar, for instance?
I haven't been quite that brave yet.
Well, you talked about some of the shortcuts, because pot pies, they can be labor-intensive. What is the shortest amount of time in which we can pull off a decent pot pie at home?
So the skillet chicken pot pie with biscuit topping that I included in the recipe, or in the story, is actually a 30-minute affair, and I rarely claim that 30 minutes is actually the time limit. But if you're organized, you can pull it off in 30 minutes. And that's even with a homemade biscuit topping. If you used biscuits from a can, it would be even faster. But the biscuit recipe I included is so simple. It's from America's Test Kitchen, and they're geniuses. It was a really easy biscuit. You don't have to cut in butter. You just stir in cream, and the biscuits bake in 15 minutes while you're cooking the chicken breasts, and it actually calls for frozen carrots and peas, so you're not doing a lot of chopping, and the onion is the only thing that you're chopping up.
Well, that sounds good. And that one is up on the Central Time Facebook page as well. And that one, is it cooked, did you say, is it in a skillet or does that go in the oven?
It's in a skillet. So you start off on the stovetop, and you do your onions, your butter, your flour, your chicken broth, your cream, and you get that sauce going. You also cook the chicken breasts right in with it. You chop up the chicken breasts, and while you're doing all that, your biscuits are actually baking. So they're baked separately for this one, which is a little bit of a shortcut and a little different than a traditional pastry lid, but just as delicious. And then when it's done, you just put the, actually, it doesn't even go into the oven. You just put the biscuits right on top and serve it that way.
Oh, that sounds good. And what about herbs to go into this? Which one, what would you advise for that?
You know, traditional ones are going to be things like thyme, obviously salt and pepper, but thyme is really versatile and is great with all those vegetables and chicken. Fresh parsley is always nice, too, near the end, but thyme is definitely my favorite.
And if you wanted to kind of mix up the traditional chicken pot pie that you're talking about with some different vegetables or different twists, what would you recommend?
Yeah, you could go a couple different ways. Since we're still nearing, you know, we're not into the full growing season yet, you could still use a lot of those root vegetables, things like turnips and parsnips and carrots and rutabaga would all be really lovely in a pie, and they would bake up beautifully in the oven. Another thing that I mentioned is that you can kind of do a whole different flavor profile, and one recipe I saw, I didn't include it, but just in my research, I saw a curried chicken pot pie, and they used coconut milk to thicken the sauce and some lemongrass and curry, sweet curry, and it just sounded really lovely.
Do you have a favorite pot pie yourself that you like to make?
You know, I'm a traditionalist. I really like the basic chicken, but I like it with a pastry crust. And you can mix and match a lot of these pot pie recipes, too. You can take the filling you like and either do a puff pastry, a biscuit, or a traditional pastry pie crust lid.
One thing I've liked when I've had pot pie is when I'm eating out. I don't make them often at home, once in a while, but I like it when people use mashed potatoes in sort of the broth. What do you think about that?
Oh, right in the broth to thicken it up? That's a great idea.
Yeah, you get a nice hearty spoonful of mashed potatoes. I don't know if it's still, I guess it's still a pot pie. What's the definition of a pot pie?
Well, I mean, where I've seen mashed potatoes used is spread on top and then baked, and then that's more traditionally called a shepherd's pie.
Okay, so mashed potatoes, maybe a little more leaning shepherd-y there.
Yeah, but still delicious, and I've seen people do it with sweet potatoes, too, which is a nice twist.
And our producer, Chris Molina, is sharpening his cooking skills lately. He wants to know, with the cooking part, can you puncture the top of the pot pie to check the temperature, or do you want to sort of leave it intact and let everything get nice and bubbly inside?
Well, you actually typically have some vents cut in there already just to let steam escape. So you know things are done when the crust is nice and golden brown, and you'll see the bubbling juices along the edges are coming up through those vents.
We're talking right now with food writer Anna Thomas Bates about pot pies in honor of Pie Day, which is tomorrow. And we'd like to hear from you on this. Have you tried making homemade pot pies? Do you try any interesting ingredients? And what about the time? Any labor-saving aspects that you figured out to make a delicious pot pie at home? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with food writer Anna Thomas Bates about pot pie recipes to celebrate Pie Day 314. That's tomorrow. And we want to hear from you. Do you have questions about how to make your own pot pies? Do you have any non-traditional ingredients in your dish? You can let us know over on the Central Time Facebook page. It's 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or again, you can check out a recipe and post your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll go to our callers now. Tom is joining us first in Janesville. Tom, hi.
Hi. Well, I was calling about New Zealand and Australia. New Zealand and Australia eat more meat pies and pot pies than any other countries in the world. And when I was traveling down there, I learned to make them, and I make them yet here. They're, 3 or 4 inches across, and they don't do hamburgers down there or anything else. Every place you go, from a gas station to a cafe to a restaurant, what people buy is these little pot pies, meat pies. And they make them breakfast varieties with cheese and egg and sausage or bacon. Of course, down there, bacon is any kind of pork. I even ate a possum pot pie while I was down there.
Really? Wow. How was it?
Museum. It was very good. Very good. And so they have a variety of gravies and a variety of types. But, I mean, there, they don't have hamburger stands. They have the meat pie stands, and that's what you eat for snacks. And so I do them here with a puff pastry. Works great. Just use a little circular cutter, and you can buy these little metal tart pans at the kitchen stores, and that's what I make them in. And I'll make, a couple dozen at a time of different types, breakfast types and that, and then freeze them and then put them in the microwave whenever I want one.
Oh, that sounds great and super convenient, too. Tom, thanks a lot for sharing that about the New Zealand pot pie tradition. Sounds like it's going gangbusters in New Zealand. And Anna, what do you think about making sort of individual versions?
That's a nice way to do it, and I'm guessing what Tom is talking about is it sounds maybe like it's a hand pie, like you fold it over and seal it together, so you probably don't even need a fork for that sort of pot pie. And those freeze really nicely, and it is a nice way to, you can pop it right in the oven and really eat it without a lot of fuss. But if you're not going to make them individually like that, you can, if you have an oven-proof, like a 2-cup oven-proof bowl, you can have a couple of those, 4 to 6 of those, put in about a cup and a half of your filling, and then drape a square of puff pastry or straight pastry over the top and bake it that way. So you can do individual servings in a bowl, or you can do hand pies like they do in Australia.
Do you think you could make them in muffin tins?
Yes, you definitely can. And puff pastry is really nice for that. So you cut a square, you tuck it in, you put your filling in top on the top, and then you just fold over the corners. So it's not completely covered on top, but it makes a nice little individual package.
The portability factor is nice.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for that call. And we're going to go next to Dolores in Kenosha. Hi, Dolores.
Oh, hi. Oh, you're talking about the individual ones in muffin tins. I have to speak up. Go to BettyCrocker.com. They have all those impossible pies, and you can do a ton of those,
okay,
which are great for kids.
Well, thanks for that idea.
It's the perfect size for them. But I've had a pie that I've made for about the last 10 years, and I started doing it after Thanksgiving, and I call it Thanksgiving pie. And, okay, I have the rolled out, the pie rolls. I didn't make my own thing. And I get those, and I said, okay, well, you need about 5 cups of ingredients.
And I bet all your Thanksgiving leftovers go right in there.
Yes, they do. And you got to measure it out, because you have, you know, when you take apart the turkey, well, you slice the nice meats and put them somewhere so that people can make sandwiches. Which maybe you have, you know, like 2 cups of mashed potatoes and 1 cup of the green bean casserole, maybe some sweet potatoes, things like that. You don't try not to mash it together. You gently put it in there.
Wow, that sounds like a fantastic little Thanksgiving dinner reborn in a pot pie. What do you think about that kind of thing? We just sort of put some like-minded ingredients together from a leftover meal, Anna.
I'm a huge fan of mashing together all Thanksgiving ingredients any time of the year. And you could even go as far, if you didn't want to make the pastry, you could use your mashed potatoes on top, or you could use the stuffing on top and then add that gravy in there to keep everything moist. And that sounds fantastic.
Thanksgiving is the perfect meal to be doing that, because everything kind of tastes the same. Well, at least at our Thanksgiving dinner it does, because everything has sage in it. Are there other meals that would lend themselves well?
You know, I'd have to think about that. But I think any time you're getting complementary flavors together and you're adding kind of a rich sauce or gravy, you're going to have a winner. You know, if you have lamb and some herbs that go well with lamb and that gravy. The other pot pie that I featured in my recipe was a Sonoran beef pot pie. So it actually had a Southwestern flavor profile. We had beans and lime juice and bacon and cheese and sour cream, and then it had a cornbread crust on top.
Oh, so there's lots of different ways you can go with this. All right, we're going to go next to Dan in Superior. Dan, hi.
Yeah, hi. I'm driving down the road, and I hope I don't lose you, but I'm a big fan of savory meat pies, and I've been experimenting with them for a long time, and I appreciate some of the ideas, especially that the curry chicken pie, really great. Typically, when I make one, I will buy pre-made pastry, some puff pastry, and I'll make pie, so there's a bottom crust as well as a top crust. So it's not really a pot pie, because it's not made in a pot. It's made more like in a pie tin, normal, regular-sized pie tin. My favorite one that I make currently is little out of the box, but I like it a lot, and it's tongue and kidney pie. So I prepare the tongue, you know, in a pressure cooker, and I clean the kidneys and saute them up and put them together and make a roux with potatoes, usually some carrots, onions, and then I'll make 3 or 4 of them, put a few of them in the freezer, and then bake them up at a later time when I can enjoy them.
Again, we're getting at the convenience factor here. Dan is obviously a big fan of pot pies. What do you think about his approach, Anna?
I love it. I love using interesting meats like that. It sounds very British and very delicious. Yeah, and it's a nice way to use some meats that might be tougher ahead of time, you know, a brisket or something like that. You can braise that meat ahead of time. You could even use part of that for its own meal, and then you could use those leftovers, combine it with a nice gravy or sauce and those vegetables and your crust, and you're going to have a great second meal.
And since we're coming up on St. Patrick's Day as well as Pi Day, two big holidays here, what do you recommend if we want to Irish up our pot pie a little?
Oh, I would do a lamb, like a lamb shank, braise a lamb shank, pull that meat off, and then I would use Guinness as part of the base of my sauce. So you'd have a really rich gravy with that lamb. You could have peas and onions and carrots in there, and and then I'd use a pastry top.
Now, since this is Wisconsin, I feel obliged to ask, does cheese have any place in a pot pie?
You know, anything goes in a pot pie. And actually, the beef pot pie that I did have a layer of cheese just underneath the cornmeal crust and some cheese mixed into the cornmeal. Traditionally, you don't see it, and you don't really need it because that gravy is going to keep everything really nice and moist. But it is Wisconsin, so if you want to put some cheese in there, then go right ahead.
I suppose you could do a cheese sauce, something like a Mornay sauce.
You could. You could do a cheese sauce, or you could mix some cheese right into the pastry crust as well, just like an apple cheddar pie. You could do something similar.
And Anna, before we let you go, what would you say to someone who's hesitant to make their very first pot pie?
I'd say just go for it. There is, even if it looks misshapen and ugly, it is still going to be delicious. It's hard to screw up, and you put so much time and love in it that everyone is going to just be very happy that you made them a pot pie.
And what pie are you going to be celebrating with tomorrow on Pie Day?
You know, I think I make one of each. I'm going to do just the chicken and biscuit because I love that one so much, and my son loves the biscuits. And I think I'm just going to do, I have actually strawberries that I've frozen from the summer, so we might go crazy and do a summer strawberry pie.
Oh, sounds fantastic. Well, Anna, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Anna Thomas-Bates, freelance writer and blogger at tallgrasskitchen.com with some tips for making homemade pot pies in honor of Pie Day, which is celebrated tomorrow. Well, there's a handful of fun movie news that's worth sharing for fans of the Star Wars franchise. Disney and Lucasfilms just announced the title of the next standalone Star Wars movie. It's called Rogue One, and it stars Oscar nominee Felicity Jones, who was nominated for Best Actress in the movie The Theory of Everything. And, of course, by this point, the new Star Wars stuff bears pretty much no resemblance at all to the first three with Luke and Han Solo, but hey, it's still Star Wars, and that one is coming out next December. And this is either great news or news that will completely ruin your week, but Disney has anteed up and announced that, yes, it will in fact make a sequel to their hit movie, Frozen. And this is good news because it could give kids an entirely new song to torture grown-ups with. And the new Frozen sequel might just answer this deep, almost unanswerable existential question.
Do you want to build a snowman? Come on, let's go and play. I never see you anymore. Come out the door. It's like you've gone away. We used to be best buddies, and now we're not. I wish you would tell me why. Do you want to build a snowman?
Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll review the biggest headlines from around the state this week in Wisconsin. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is off. You're listening to Central Time.